They didn't seem to have any problem in dealing with the Anglicans, the O'Neills. Oh. But they were Catholics.
Well, I found quite interesting was we had a session the other day with Florence Cronin.
Oh, yeah.
And she was a Gibbons.
Yeah, she was a Gibbons.
And they all went to the public school.
Yeah, they all went to the public school. I went to school with Florence and Mary.
Sure.
And they went to public. There were just the two families, though, at O'Neill's and Gibbons's. And we used to have, the minister used to come on Friday afternoon for a religious program, and Gibbons's always went home. But the O'Neill stayed to see what they always stayed for the religious education. But the Gibbons's always went home.
I feel they may get lettuce red.
Yeah. Mrs. Gibbons was a Galini. And they were great strong Catholics. Well, she was. Her and Grandpa Lee, they used to have Lee have an awful battle. She'd say the orange breeches, tell them she'd open, either ground them out or roast them out. Sitting on that corner, you see, was on the north side of the road here was the old hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And on the south side was a blacksmith shop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the road went straight through.
Yep.
And the old hotel, well, it was there for years.
Was it, did it look like a hotel, or was it just like a big house?
Well, it was a batten board, you know, those narrow boards, and mm-hmm. It was a big frame building. And Harold Wood had it. You see, he had this property here, and this 70 acres over here. He had this corner, and there was a little barn there, too. I guess the barn was where they put the horses in at night, you see, when they stayed in the hotel.
Okay.
And then this was a Moriarty farm in here. Harold had this 70 acres here, and then the other 130 was belonged to Bateman, Elwood Bateman had it, and his dad before him, Jonathan Bateman, and that made up the 200 acres here. This was 70 and then 130 mm-hmm. For Legnews down there. They lived there. And this was the 70. I don't know how come they split 70 off. And that would be lot 15. No, it'd be 16.
16.
When
yeah.
You cross the highway.
16 North Avenue.
Harold Wood. South half of lot 16, concession 11, 1921. He bought it from Glover's. Glover's had the blacksmith shop and had that corner lot up there. You see where the hotel was. That belonged to Glover's. And then they've sold it to Harold Wood in 1921.
McAfee's again.
McAfee's had it before that. Yeah.
Yeah, they're all mixed up in this corner, too.
Yeah, a lot of McAfee's, yeah.
The McAfee's and the Moriarty's are all mixed up together.
Yeah. And then Bismarck Roberts, you see, Tommy Latham had a little house up there, and Bismarck Roberts bought it from Tommy Latham. And they were a little house just on the just down the hill, you see. There was a house there north of the old hotel. That's when Jerry got married, and Bismarck moved up there.
You haven't got any pictures of that hotel? Don't have any pictures of it?
I don't think so, no.
What did you do with with the blacksmith shop? Did he do shoeing horses and all that type of thing for you?
Yeah.
Was he the guy you went to around here that we're gonna work?
Yeah. But I never knew it as a working blacksmith shop. It was closed when I went to school. It was closed. But we used to go into it. Harold used to take us in. And then when Jerry got left this property, when Harold died, Jerry got this property. And then and I think about all he got out of the old blacksmith shop was the anvil. It was a big blacksmith anvil. Mm-hmm. It's down at the barn down there.
Where would be the next blacksmith shop? Was there one in, the McKinstry's in Bradford would be the next one?
Yeah, there were probably one at Box down there at Mount Pleasant. Mm-hmm. And then in Bradford, yeah.
You're still here, it's kind of light on this north side.
Well, this was at one time, this was all grass down the bottom. A hell of a thing, wet in there. Awful wet. When Marty's had it, I plowed in there, and oh, God, you'd get stuck. And you couldn't drain it. There was a chunk in there while hammers had cleaned it up. This is the lot line here. I severed all of these lots. Lot 17. Jack Stewart, who was a bachelor, he had this farm here. He was a good farmer.
Okay, now is that any relation to Doug?
Doug, yeah, uncle. Doug's father was Stanley, and he was a brother of Jack. And they lived on the ninth there, across from Shirley Bowles.
On the
north side, that's where Doug Stewart was raised.
Okay.
That was Stanley Stewart. That was a big family.
Mm-hmm.
And but Jack here was a bachelor. He wasn't married. And his sister kept house, Roberta Stewart, kept house for, she worked in Toronto, but then she retired and came back here.
Yeah.
And looked after her mother, lived to be quite an age here. And she was, those older people, they just went to bed and stayed in bed pretty well all the time. And we used to visit there. I used to go there with mother to visit, and she always had peppermints.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a great, great thing for us.
Yeah.
She always give you peppermint candy.
Yeah.
But she was upstairs in bed.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew her to be anywhere out.
Huh?
And it was the same with my Aunt Aggie and Jenny, their mother. She was in bed for years.
Yeah.
And they looked after her.
Sure.
They seemed those older people, they just went to bed.
Yeah.
And they were daughters or whatever stayed, and Aunt Aggie and Aunt Jenny and Uncle Chris, they were none of them married, and Aunt Aggie had a boyfriend in the States, but the mother wouldn't let her get married, you see, so she had to stay at home and look after her, and she never got married, but she did have a boyfriend, because she was a nice looking lady.
Yep.
Aunt Aggie.
Well, I had an aunt like that too. I wouldn't. Grandpa and Grandma wouldn't let her get married.
Yeah.
Not gonna marry that guy.
Yeah.
Well,
that's what they were. They went.
So this was the original Fennel farm was 200 acres.
Yeah, 17 and 18.
That's north half of 17 and 18.
Yeah.
Is this a loamy like the?
This is a loam. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're back to that.
Yeah.
To Schomburg clay loam, pretty much.
Yeah. This was, there was, 30 acres in there from the top of the hill east that you could work there, or you could get on that first thing in the spring.
Yeah.
And would dry. and you could always, you never would have a crop failure on that 30 acres there. It was beautiful land to work. Now when you got back here, piece, it got a little heavier.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you got over to the Mundy farm, that was heavy clay land.
Yeah.
You got clay land over there. What would they say? What would they say on the thing there? Probably going, I guess, lately.
Well, they don't get into that, and I forgot to bring the soil map with me. It would have been interesting to have had the soil map to follow along with it.
But it was pine.
But here they're talking, we're in what?
17.
17 and 18. Be what they're saying. 17, when we first started there, was just cedar. Tape, the second tape with John on May the 7th. And we're sitting here in front of the beginnings of the Fennel Farm on the south side, lot 17, or the north half of 17, concession 10. Okay, John, now you're saying this was considered to be pine land?
Yes, lot 17 was quite a pine forest, and my great-grandfather cleared that, and the logs, one log was a sleigh load, and they were hauled and put on the train at Guilford, and they made two trips a day, two teams, and they made two trips a day. And they loaded the logs when they came back, and from the second load, they loaded the logs for the first thing in the morning. And they always jacked the sleigh runners up off the ground, that they could, that they didn't get frozen into the tracks, so the sleigh runners were smooth when they started out in the morning. Because if you had frosted on your sleigh runners, why, that was heavy going in, so they always raised them up. And they always had one team of Clydesdale horses that were used for the bushwork and the sleighing, and they were never allowed to trot. They always were on the walk, and they could walk to Bradford, which was a distance of about 5 miles, 4.5 to 5 miles, and they could do that in the hour flat with a load. But they never were allowed to go on the trot. They always were on the walk and trained that way, and then if you're trained that way, they took big steps, so they made better time uphill and down. And when my great-grandfather pulled the stumps on the lot 17, he had a stumping machine, and he had the horses trained by command, no lines. By command. And on lot 18, in front of the house, there was a 6-acre orchard in here. And in this area here, there's a 6-acre orchard there. And my grandfather plowed that with a single furrow plow and cultivated it. And also that was plowed and worked with the with no command, by command.
Mm-hmm.
And those six acre orchard, we picked there in the fall on the northern spies. There's quite a lot of northern spies there, and put them in barrels, and they were shipped to England. Shipped apples to England. We took them down to Fleury's orchard in Aurora. Fleury had a big orchard in Aurora. And we took them there, and then Curry's shipped their apples and ours together. And the northern spies were shipped to England.
How many trees, how many apple trees did you have?
We had 6 acres.
6 acres, all northern spies?
No, they were all different.
Yeah.
All different brands.
Yeah.
There was what they called an Ontario apple. It was something similar to a northern spy, but not as good a keeper as a northern spy. And the Ontario apple all went out. We lost all the Ontario apples, about an acre of them, 1931 and 32 in the big freeze.
Yeah.
Deep freeze.
Mm-hmm.
And the trees, when they snap at night, they just go off like a cannon. Just when they snap, frost, split them. Try to take the whole 1 acre, just came right out of the center. And we never replanted it. But we had Baldwin's and Ascot's.
So then, did you take the orchard out when you started? Or was it taken out before?
It was still there when I started, but it was getting old then.
There was an orchard when we bought, we had an orchard at the farm in Downsville, which we never used. It was there when we left. And when we came up to the farm at Bradford here, there was an orchard there. So it was one of the first things we did. We took it, put the bulldozer to it, and put it into a heap and burn it.
That was nice land for an orchard in there.
Nice slope to it.
Yeah, it was then loomy. Nice land for orchard. This one you got on this side, it was about a little heavier and a little wetter. It wouldn't be as nice for an orchard.
No.
A lot of stone on Lot 18 here.
Mm-hmm.
Stone piles, and we bulldozed out. But they made a stone pile around the great big stone. That's how they did, and then we got bulldozers in, but all of this.
Did you see any sign of a shoreline up in here? Like, say you're on here. We're starting now.
Well, this comes across from, actually starts way down in the settlement, and this is a high ridge of land going right through here,
mm-hmm.
and ends up at Guilford, you see.
Yeah.
And this is the Indian track through here. Okay. This is where they crossed. And end up in Guilford, and they're on the high land here. This is the highest ridge, behind us.
Mm-hmm.
This is the highest ridge. And that's where they were coming across down there on the 6th, they must have started down at the marsh there somewhere, the Indians. And then, because there was an Indian encampment at Guilford, you see. But this is the track they followed. And over on that Mundy farm, I've dug up Indian axe heads and things like that. Mm-hmm. I dug them up over there, because that's where they were coming through. And it was stony, too. That ridge is always was stony.
See, what I was getting at, like, you're on the edge of Lake Algonquin at one time. This was the shoreline. This was from here down was, like, the water might have come up this high at one time. So you got the shore thing, I wouldn't say for sure, but I think that's the type of thing that you. And when you get up to Guilford, it's the shoreline goes way back, almost right back to Highway 11.
Yeah.
There's a long, long slope there down to the lake.
Yeah. Well, then down here, though, further down is the shoreline too, right?
Yeah. Well, there could be a whole series of these shorelines.
Yeah, well, down here, the old shoreline still shows up where the big rocks all along on the bottom end of Edney's property below the railway there.
Mm-hmm.
That's an old shoreline, too, you see.
I see. Now, this is the Roberts place.
Yeah.
Again, here is another one of these old barns. See?
Yeah.
But your barn, was is that the second barn?
Yeah. It was burned in 22.
Yeah.
That's an old barn. Now, the one in the front here, where Fairview is, that's been built first. The original barn is the one behind it, and it is old. There's big beams in there, tremendous-sized beams in it. It's an old barn.
This has been in the Roberts family since day one.
They have the original deed, but they don't. It was belonged to other people before them. William Roberts didn't get it till 1849. Before that, it changed hands there quick.
Mm-hmm.
29, August, October, and October. Yeah. And then in a few years, and then it was December, William Heritage, and William Roberts, he came from Niagara Falls and bought it for the boys. Francis, his mother. This was wet here and was wet here. I had to tile this field here.
Yeah. And springs coming out of the hill.
Springs coming out of the hill, yeah. It was wet. Real wet. And this is springy in here. Coming out of the hill. Now this here, this farm here, this was a 50-acre chunk here, here.
This is the
at one time, and the road was, the laneway was there. It was 50 acres, and that was owned by Luther Roberts, and John Hamley's farm was what they called the String 100. It ran right through.
This is the south half of lot. What is it? South half of lot 19.
19.
South half of 19. South half of 19.
West half. John had family, yeah, the east half of lot 19, that's that one there, you mm-hmm. see.
Okay.
And then John Hamley bought this 50 acres and joined it up with that, you see.
This is your great grandfather?
Yeah. Well, no, this would be a brother of my grandfather, Joseph Fennell.
Who was Squire Fennell?
That was my great grandfather.
That's your great grandfather.
Yeah, Squire Fennell. And then Joseph was. This was the Squire. Joseph Fennell was the Squire, and James Fennell was my grandfather. Okay. Joseph Fennell was Squire Fennell. Okay. Yeah.
What qualified a person to be known as Squire?
Well, I don't know whether they brought that title from Ireland or what, but he was always known as Squire Fennell when he came in.
There's a Squire Fennell, there's a Squire McConkie, there's Squire Macbeth, and there's one other one.
Was there McManus? No.
I think it's four Squires.
Yeah.
I just wondered what it was that qualified a person to be.
See, I understand that my great-grandfather, Joseph Fennell, when he came out, he never worked. He always had help inside and outside.
Yeah.
He had two hired men outside, and he never worked. So he must have come out with enough money that he was able to do that.
He managed.
Yeah,
sure.
And he sat in the front room and ate by himself. Yeah, he ate in the dining room. He didn't eat with hired help or the rest. He ate by himself. And they always brought the buggy to the door. When he was going away, they brought the buggy to the door, and he went to town every day. He had a horse that would go to Bradford in 15 minutes, like that was the criteria he used. He went for the mail every day at 12 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
And that was... And Bismarck Roberts remembers him. And when Bismarck was going to the school, they always had a gate on the gate. Bismarck was anyways near, they always made him open the gate for him and shut it. He kept coming for school. I had a cousin, Emma Fennell, that knew him. She was little. And they had a fireplace, and he had this great big wing chair. And he sat in front of the fireplace, and the same as everybody else, they just took what was left.
You always left, didn't you?
Yeah. He was Squire.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
Well, he was the boss.
Well, true. And, you know, but the thing that I think that we, you know, we have to try and capture, I don't know, and I spoke to you about this before, is that, yeah, there were people in the township who were movers and shakers.
Yeah.
Who were those people? Like, who were the people, like, you know, we come down to this concession, like, you know, we talked to a lot of people who really basically just existed on the farm.
Yeah, that's right.
They existed. But there were some one or two or three or four families in that group
who
got out and...
Well, Squire Fennel was a Reed, you see.
But they were the ones who said that. Who was it that brought the people together to build the church?
Yeah.
Who was it that brought the people
and
together?
And a very far-sighted person over here was Frank Hamley, too, who was Reeve, and then he was one of the instigators of the Hall March.
That's right. Yeah.
He was far-sighted. Yeah. And he was a businessman, you'd say.
Yeah. Well, the person who could see that the potential, that's the thing, and it's a...
always had a joke with this, Frank Hamley, he never really liked, I don't think he liked the farming aspect of it, because he was in the insurance business, eh? John Hamley would take him up to the corner on the sleigh, and Frank would have a fedora on and dressed up, you know, and Jack Stewart. Like he was the old type. We couldn't figure that out, how anybody could be farming and going with. But Frank was a good manager. I mean, the work was being done at home.
Oh, yeah.
Like John, his son, was a good farmer, and he was doing the work, and Frank, he was selling insurance. Mm-hmm. He was an insurance.
Yeah.
And then Frank also sold the bonds when that Collingwood elevator was built, it went belly up, like,
uh-huh.
And that ticked some of the people off around here. He sold bonds to, I think it was a $2,000 bond or something when they built those Collingwood elevators.
Yeah.
And it was back in the Depression came, you see,
and
that elevator, well, I guess it got going again, but it went bankrupt.
That's right, yeah. Well, we've all had those kind of opportunities, John.
Yeah.
So this was, what the, this
Charlie
is?
Edney.
Charlie Edney.
And he came from Yorkshire, England.
Here on the north half of Concession, lot 19.
Yeah.
North half of 19, Concession 10.
Charlie Edney, 1907.
I see our old friend Scanlon has been stuck with us.
The McAfees were in here too, you see.
Okay, they were down here.
They were here. McAfees were here.
Yeah, and then that's here.
Mark Scanlon,
at the south half, he's on the south half.
Yeah. And Albert Scanlon, he was a relative of mine. Albert Scanlon married that fella Fennel. Mark. Well, old Mark Scanlon, I guess he was the lawyer in Bradford.
Yeah.
Mark Scanlon. But Charlie Edney, it looks as if he came here in 1907, bought it from the McAfees, eh?
Yeah.
That was the power of sale.
And then they would have gone back over then to the other farm we saw over on the other side.
Yeah. So how come this would carry on here like Charlie Edney?
Well, that's likely one of those things where I'm not sure of all.
And then Walter got in 1961.
Yeah.
But it was owned by...
You have to watch it. You see, that's so we're back in the south half here.
Oh, yeah.
You see, one here is the whole thing.
North half, you see.
See, one,
they
north
always
half.
Had the north half.
Yeah.
Charlie always had the north half.
So you got to watch when you're going down those, if you're getting there. You see, look for the twos. I think it's the twos or the threes or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I see.
Because when Marcia did it, she used a highlighter. Different colors.
Oh, yeah.
And we couldn't produce that. So here you see it goes there. I think that's a two there, isn't it?
Two.
And you don't see any more, don't see another two when you get down here.
Yeah,
so
right.
It went from Charlie Edney to Walter.
Walter in 1961.
The rest of this all has to do with the south half.
South half.
I got all mixed up with the...
Yeah, that's right. Parents knew so I had the chunk over there. Yeah, the railway cut it up, you see, that south part there, it cut it up, the railway
it through on an angle there. Yep. I don't think it took much off of this barn, of this 100 acres, but it cut into the other barn.
The railroad is right on the edge of the wetland, isn't it?
Yeah.
They didn't go back out and get on it much on the highland at all. They stayed right. Of course, that gave them flat land to build on, eh?
Yeah.
Which is what they wanted. They wanted to get. They don't want to be up anywhere where there's hills. So this is the end of, where does this lot end? Down here?
There'll be a lot to be buried on the hill here, yeah.
Right on the hill here.
Yeah, and I think Edney's had more than 100 acres because they had this. This would be the lot line running through here, so they'd have a little bit more.
So
it cut a bit off on the other end.
The beginnings of lot 20, you're going down the steep grade towards the railway track,
yep.
And then you're into the real, into the flats.
Yeah, and that's just the shoreline.
Yeah.
That's a stony, like it's a, mm-hmm. There was stones all through there, but that's the old shoreline of the lake. Original lake, wherever.
Lake Algonquin.
Lake Algonquin,
that was the Glacier Lake.
Just an extension of Lake Simcoe.
Well, before, yeah.
Yeah, there's a shoreline here where these rocks were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, they ran right through there. Yeah. I don't know what family they're doing there. There was a, they did have a crusher in one time, but crushing those stones up. It's wet down here.
Well, the thing is to get any grade to drain it, eh?
Yeah. The Hamleys used to have this. I think they had Frank Hamley had 100 acres down in here. Edney's had 100 acres down here. Charlie Edney, east part or residue of north half of lot, being the whole of the north half of lot, they had 100 acres down here, below the track. And that'd be north half of lot 20. And then 21, I think John Hamley, Goviad, yeah, Frank Hamley had this next 100 here, and then he sold it to Goviad. And then from John F. Hamley in 51 to White, lifetime income. And then 22, you got right Joe Hamley. Was out more further out on the marsh there.
Who's Joe?
Joe Hamley that lived in Bradford there. And then he had the farm up on the highway there.
Where does Milton come into this?
Well, Milton is the son of Wes Hamley. There was Frank Hamley, Wes Hamley, and Bill Hamley. And John Hamley is Frank's son, and Milton is Wes' son, and Joe is Bill Hamley's son. And Bill Hamley lived there on the highway, on the west side, across from Perugini's, on that side. That was the Bill Hamley farm.
Is that where Milton was raised?
No, Milton was on the north of Perugini's, on the north side of the 12th, east of, on the east side there.
Okay.
That was Wes Hamley. And then Milton was his son, and then Amelia, who was another, was a sister, and she married Bob Leonard, who lived out on the first concession there, on that, bend, you know, on 27 Highway.
Yeah, he had the Guernsey cattle.
Well, no, he didn't have Guernseys. He built a lot on the old road that went around there, mm-hmm. on the west, just on the west side.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's a house there. Yeah. That was where Bob Leonard lived.
and he always picked up enough bottles off the road to buy a car. Amelia's still living. That's no consistent. There's no doctor. This was all, at one time, was all pretty well. Well, they cropped it, I guess, a bit, but mostly pasture.
Oh, well, you can remember when it was like this over here to the left. Was it like that before, or who cleared it?
Well, this was always bush, I mean.
I see.
But this was clear.
This was cleared quite a while.
This was Edney's, and they did crop down here, pasture the cattle. The pasture the cows down here and brought them across the railway at night, put them down in the morning and didn't walk at night. You know, I always had a time of where they knew pretty well when that 5 o'clock train was going.
Yeah. So, go down and get the cattle up before the train went through.
Yeah.
Or after.
Yeah, one or the other. It was 5 o'clock train, well, they'd get it before because they always were early.
Yeah. Well, that's...
Out of Edney's here, they do them in the winter time.
Well, they would pay for it, of course, was it?
Yeah, they'd buy it for buy the sleigh roll, I guess. They cut it in big long poles, with poplar, poplar. Maybe a bit of elm, pissing on it. And Jack would draw it up every winter, and he knew exactly how many loads of wood he needed for the winter, and they draw it up and then buzz it up in the spring and pile it up, split it and pile it. This is the winter's wood.
You know, I was talking to in the write-up that Irene did. She mentioned that they used to do the same thing. They go back up in the winter, cut the bush, bring it up, and then they would buzz it up. She mentioned that they had a. They used to drive the buzzsaw with a Z engine. Do you have any idea what the Z engine would be? And from what I understand, from what she told me, it was like a, I would imagine it's likely about a 5 or 6 horsepower engine. She said it stood about this high and had a flywheel. I expect this might be one of those old hit and miss jobs.
Well, Wilford Wood had a Lister engine, and he buzzed wood with it. Lister, one cylinder or two cylinder, I forget now. Well, Stewart has he refinished a Lister engine, my brother-in-law, a Lister engine, and he refinished a Lister, all did it all over. And that was Wilford Wood had a Lister engine and cut wood with it. And Tommy Gibbons had a Fortson, and he took a heart attack from cranking that Fortson. In cold weather, they were hard to start. That gave him a heart attack, cranking that thing. And Graham Matthews, he used to buzz for us, but he had a motor on the back of an old truck. Buzz with it, like he had a gasoline motor, I guess, out of a car, sitting on the back, and in the front end he drove it, like it was just an open air thing.
And then did he have a belt on the saw, or was it a direct
belt?
Drive?
No belt.
Belt.
And then he used it too for. We had a drag saw, eh?
Mm-hmm.
And we got Graham a couple of years to drive the drag saw, but it was a terrible thing because you had to go full out, you see, whether you couldn't idle it down. And when you're removing the log, you know, if you didn't have a nice smooth log to jig up and you needed a bit more time or something, that old saw would just be a whipping. You know, it was a wonder somebody wasn't killed with this drinking thing, you know. It was going full speed. Well, then, of course, when we got our own tractor, a W4 tractor, then we always had somebody sitting on the tractor that when you went to jig a log up, you slowed the tractor down, you see.
Sure.
because when you had her run wide open, well, you pulled the lever for the clutch, you see. Well, sometimes you'd scoot the damn log way too far. You only wanted to bring it 16 inches, and you'd maybe end up 2 feet. Well, then in a great big log, how are you going to get it back, So, but then when we got the tractor, then you'd idle it right down, you see, and then you could just inch it up. It's nice and slow, you see. But when it was going wide open, that old saw would just be a whamming, whipping, you know. You wonder it didn't fly apart.
Well, you kind of laugh when you see all the rules and regulations they have now about safety in the workplace.
When you think back on that darn thing, you know.
Well, so many of the things on the farm were the same way.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing that there were, you know.
There weren't more people.
Yeah. Well, now, there were a lot of people maimed. Like, you know.
Cutting boxes.
I remember, I don't know how long it was. We hadn't been up on the farm. They had an exhibition, a fair, like a show in Bradford. And we set up a display of old farm equipment. And we had some people brought in old cutting boxes and turnip slicers. I remember Earl Rowe was the lieutenant governor at the time. We were walking through there and he said, "Oh, I can remember so and so. He got his hand off one of these things, you know." It's absolutely incredible.
Well, quite a few lost their arm in it. Jimmy Sloan, he lost his arm in it. Keith Neshaw's father, he lived out in Bondhead. He lost his arm in a cut box.
Did he? I knew he had his arm off.
Yeah, in a cut box.
Yeah.
Well, there was a lot of that cut box. Tried it stuck or something, and they tried to feed it in, and then grabbed it and took their arm in.
That's right.
But I often think back, you know, this drag saw, my God, I wonder what somebody killed with that saw flailing around. Because sometimes there was a slot that you got it up in it, but if it was going full speed, it would still whip, you know. There was a rig for cutting the big stuff. Oh.